Welcome to the Telehealth and Medicine Today Journal podcast series, where research and innovation collide. Today's topic is AI and reimbursement, featuring Charles Dunham, principal shareholder and corporate healthcare attorney at Greenberg Traurig, Matthew Fisher, partner at Hancock Daniel & Johnson, and esteemed moderator, Dr. Aditi Joshi, global digital health consultant and best-selling author. Let's hear what they have to say.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this podcast for Telehealth and Medicine Today. My name is Aditi Joshi. I'm an emergency medicine physician, CEO, global health strategist, and the author of Telehealth Success, How to Thrive in the New Age of Remote Care. And today, I'm going to be talking about with two esteemed panelists on AI and reimbursement. This has become a really big topic as we are seeing the growth of AI, both in healthcare and around in all parts of our life, essentially. And so what we're going to do today is talk about what does that mean for healthcare? How do we see reimbursement changing? Because it is different than other types of digital medicine. And how do we need companies and health systems to set their programs up? So I am very excited to have this topic, and I'm going to introduce my two panelists. We'll start with Charles Dunham. Please go ahead, Charles.
Thanks, Aditi. Pleasure to be here. Charles Dunham. I'm a corporate healthcare attorney and principal shareholder at the international law firm of Greenberg Traurig. I advise an array of healthcare providers, suppliers, other health-related entities. I have a distinct focus in lab, telehealth, medical device, and digital health technology. And I represent a range of clients from early stage startups to publicly traded companies, as well as private equity and venture capital firms to provide advice in strategic planning, fundraising, and bringing products from the lab to the market. I'm pleased to be speaking with you and Matt as well on this call.
Thanks, Charles. I know you'll also be speaking at the upcoming CONV2X Smart Tech Transformation in Healthcare this October. And we're going to, later in the podcast, get a little sneak preview of what that's going to be about. But next, and we have Matt Fisher. So Matt, please introduce yourself as well.
Nice to be speaking with you and Charles today. So my name is Matt Fisher. I'm a partner at the law firm of Hancock Daniel & Johnson. Kind of similar to Charles, I also work a lot of startup early stage companies across healthcare technology. Also kind of work with all types of care delivery organizations from small physician practices to large multi-state hospital systems and publicly traded hospital systems. And then I'm also pleased to be on the editorial board for Telehealth and Medicine Today.
Great, thank you. So I'm excited to get into this conversation. So let's get to it. So let's start out with just talking about AI reimbursement codes and how they're different from other digital medicine codes. I think we all know and have been involved in telehealth codes. We know that that has come. It actually didn't just start during the pandemic. You know, there was a large process prior that CMS had figured out how to reimburse it. There was a push by the AMA, et cetera, to get some of these codes to come through. But there has been, of course, a lot of discussion of how do we keep them permanent. But the next set of codes we probably had was with RPM, right? And RPM, of course, is with actually having devices at the home where doctors can look at the data or other types of practitioners can look at the data and then actually intervene into healthcare. And I want to say that both of these are actually very different than the way that we're talking about AI, just in the way that we practice medicine and how we're using AI. So I want to ask you guys first, how are you seeing these codes, AI reimbursement codes, different from these other digital medicine codes that we already have?
Yeah, I mean, I can start there. The telehealth services and the RPM, RTM services that you described there, I mean, one being the telehealth services has a, you know, statutory definition in the Social Security Act. And interestingly enough, the RPM and RTM are defined at the regulatory level as technology-based services, or pulling it out of telehealth and allowing it to be covered by CMS. There are ways to otherwise get coverage for some AI and ML software in that arena. But what we're seeing is that AI and ML software is in coverage of that is in fact an evolving landscape. At present, there is no Medicare benefit category for AI and ML outside of products that would fall under a durable medical equipment or DME benefit category. AMA and CMS are, establishing certain CPT and HCPCS codes for that, but it is probably one of the more limiting, issues to adoption. As always, as telehealth has faced it as well as coverage. Some of the examples, right, that we've seen is for this category and for, what was referred to as prescription digital therapeutics or PDTs, probably most well known is continuous glucose monitors. And that it goes back to 2017 when CMS assigned a HCPCS level 2 code for that. Other examples of this software-based treatments, again, attached to an app and falling into that DME category for behavioral health therapy, such as substance abuse disorders, attention deficit disorders, chronic insomnia, IBS, and the like. A more recent example that is similar to the RPM codes that you referenced, but does fall into that category of PDT coverage, are HCPCS codes for mental health services. And so they're structured in a way where it's the one code is for the device and education to the patient, and another code, pairing is for the actual monthly data review and management. And then there's additional codes for time there. There are other avenues for coverage that we've seen that aren't necessarily direct or fee-for-service submissions to Medicare programs. One is in value-based care models, right, where software and technology vendors can actually collaborate in these enterprises and to reduce costs of care and share and that shared savings and get reimbursement there. Now, that's what we would call indirect, compensation. And one area that we've found success in with our clients is with the Medicare Advantage plans. They're actually permitted to expand basic benefits to include additional modalities and telehealth service and technology that they deem to be clinically appropriate, and they can adopt it and cover it. And so we've had success, like I said, with our clients, especially with software and technology companies, with these evolving technologies and digital health to get coverage that way.
Yeah, and I agree with, I was going to say, I agree with, a lot of what Charles said, where it's, kind of, I think the common thread there is you're looking to be creative with how you're going to be seeking payment, whether it's CMS coming up with ways to fit it in within the existing reimbursement schemes, or, kind of the indirect route that Charles is talking about, where you're working with payers in different shapes or forms, or directly with, organizations that are in value-based care, where they can figure out how they want to spend their per member per month payment or other form of capitated payment. You're able to structure and come up with new modalities of how you're going to distribute that money. And, that allows you to arguably not have to fit strictly within a code definition. So, you're kind of sidestepping the codes to a degree from that perspective. At the same time, going back to your examples of the RPM and RTM codes, we've seen those evolve over time. It's, CMS doesn't necessarily tinker with them every single year, although there were a few years in a row where they were. That allows you to kind of figure out, what is the best way to be able to reimburse for the integration of technology into the delivery of care? And I think you're going to see that hopefully, reflect what is efficacious use of, whatever form of technology that you're talking about, and then kind of promote adoption from that perspective.
I agree with both of that. And I was laughing a little bit about the RPM codes. I sit on that AMA committee, and yes, we were causing some of that back and forth discussion. I think also too, when you talk about AI and the way that you're describing how we're paying for it, when you think of it from the clinical aspect, it's actually paying for the tech, this algorithmic decision-making tool, rather than what the clinician is doing, which is, even with the RPM paying for the tech, there is some of that oversight, which is part of that billing. So I think one thing that's really helpful for me when I think about this is, With the AMA, they've created an entire taxonomy of how do you look at the types of AI out there when and as we build out the type of reimbursement. So, there's three different ones for the audience who may not know. There's the first is assistive AI, which means that the machine itself is going to find the relevant data, and then the physician must interpret and report the results. Augmented by AI is that the machine, which is a second, is that the machine analyzes the data, which we've seen before, in a clinical meaningful way. So that means that there's actually something that it does that gives meaningful clinical data, but it still requires physician validation. Now, those two still are going to require the oversight that most of us are used to doing, just into different degrees. And then the last one is the autonomous AI, which is independent clinical determination. And so this is a three taxonomy, and I find it very interesting because autonomous AI actually has a code already for a diabetic retinal exam, which is something that most physicians or most people who are coding may not realize that something that seems autonomous, which it doesn't have oversight necessarily, is already having a CPT code. So thinking of that taxonomy and just your expertise in the legal aspect, how do you tell companies with these new taxonomies, with the way Medicare is going, just the thought of even the regulations around this autonomous AI versus a physician oversight? How do companies and health systems set up their programs to use these types of codes, or what do they need to think about when they're planning to implement AI into their programs?
Yeah, so I guess I can kick off on this one. I think it's, if you're talking about the companies that are developing the AI as opposed to, the hospitals or, the other groups utilizing the technology, it's going to be kind of two different decision-making paths. Looking at the company side first, I think a lot of it is going to be driven by, how much regulatory scrutiny you want to be subject to, how much, what path you want to have to go down for compliance. And then, that also influences how quickly you can get to market and what the market strategy is going to look like. If you can stay outside of clinical decision making and really, have it be something that's delivering and, potentially just presenting data to a clinician that allows for that, the oversight and the decision making by the clinicians you're describing in DD. A lot of companies try to go in that direction because then you get to stay outside of the FDA regulation because it's going to be, it's not necessarily going to be viewed as a software as a medical device. And, you can try to fall into a lower risk category where you just get to put your product out. So from that perspective, if you're going that way, you can get out there quickly. That might preclude you from being able to use some of these routes that we're talking about for specific reimbursement codes. But then you're getting into the other arrangements, that Charles had first brought up, where it's you're tapping into value-based payments or, other redistribution of money that's coming in. If you're going a fully autonomous route, obviously, that's going to require a lot more scrutiny and proving out of what the capability is, because I know we'll probably get into this, but that then starts feeding into liability. Obviously, everyone always likes to point their finger at someone else when it comes to liability, but if you're creating a piece of technology or a technology solution that is arguably delivering direct care, it's going to be much harder to reduce what your potential liability is going to be. So, that's why you want to be able to validate it. But then that also potentially brings you into a realm where, you've got specific codes that might cover that type of decision making, because now you're trying to have the technology provide some of the expertise and that professional advice. So it's, kind of, you're starting to blur the lines there.
Yeah, and playing off of what Matt said there, I mean, taking it from the company side, it's very important for the company to understand what bucket, for lack of a better phrase, right, Aditi, that they fall into, right? What and because that's going to dictate, as Matt said, specifically how and whether they're going to be regulated the FDA. And which, unfortunately, in the US is still a fragmented process, meaning Getting to market requires you to go through multiple federal agencies for a medical device if you do fall into that definition. And so thinking about, yeah, here's all the steps that I need to go down, including and the processes that you're taking, including the clinical studies. But that doesn't mean that you're going to be able to actually get reimbursed, that you're going to, as we're talking about with Medicare, that you're going to be able to have reimbursement once you've obtained FDA approval, whatever that path looks like. And so what we talked with our clients about is integrating with those studies, whatever you need to do to demonstrate that medical necessity and medical care and how that's going to be factored in, which falls into one of your bu the buckets that you're describing. Is there codes that exist? Will you fall into a particular Medicare benefit category? How will you be characterized by AMA, by CMS with this particular product or software that you're looking to introduce into the market? And then, as Matt said, on the clinician side, it's all about due diligence, right? When you're going to decide how you're going to integrate a product into your healthcare delivery workflow, who's responsible for what costs? How is it going to be covered? Is this going to be built into, your bundled service costs or per diem rates that you're taking on, or is it going to be billed separately? Who's going to be billing it separately? All of these things need to be taken into consideration, in addition to all the liability stuff that Matt, raised that we'll talk about a little bit later in our discussion here.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because when I brought up these three buckets that you both are alluding to as well and describing, what's probably happening is, there are probably more tools out there that are augmentative AI, but they're using it as assistive because they're not really ready to take the physician really out of it completely. And again, we will talk about liability. But one thing I do want to bring up, because when I ask people about what one of their fears are, it's specifically about reimbursement. Aside from liability and regulation, it's really how do we and what should we do with these time-based codes when AI is reducing physician time? That is going to really overhaul a number of the reimbursement codes that we already have. And so, what are you seeing and what are your clients thinking about when they are planning for this? Or are they thinking about it or have they thought about it?
Well, on my end, I mean, I think our clients and I think everyone in the market is otherwise suggesting that the advancement in these technologies is hopefully going to provide clinicians more time to spend with a patient and engage with them, or time to provide direct patient care rather than especially in the documentation side and the AI ML that's being developed. But it's interesting that you brought up the point of reduction in time. I think if you look at we know, the CMS and currently the folks who are in charge over at CMS are proponents of digital health, digital therapeutics, wearables, biosensors, all of that. And when you look at the proposed 2026 Medicare physician fee schedule, you'll actually see, or at least we think we're seeing, that they're taking, and CMS is taking into consideration that reduction in time, and specifically with the RPM RTM codes, meaning that they're taking the position that there is actually less time that clinicians are needing to spend, and perhaps even reducing then that reimbursement to clinicians. So I think that's a perfect example of, is this going to somehow impact or reduce reimbursement to the clinicians by adopting and utilizing this technology? And again, those are proposed rules, and we're trying to sort we're figuring out exactly where CMS is going with it, but it is a very poignant indication of perhaps where they are going.
Yeah, because I think
And
of
Charles.
it from, sorry, Matt, just one second. I was just going to say that, thinking from the clinician point, the reason I bring it up, so in the emergency room, we have codes that are based basically, like critical care codes are based on timing. And so the amount that we are reimbursed is based on how much time we spend, which includes speaking to families, a record, not only just the direct patient care at the bedside. And so all of the ambient AI, which is taking some of that time down, which I think is a benefit, it's a benefit to everybody, may be decreasing some of that. And so it's just thinking through some of the incentives. Please go ahead, Matt. I know you had something you wanted to say.
Yeah, no, I was just going to, kind of pick up on the point of the efficiency and the increased time to focus on what clinicians actually want to be focusing on that Charles brought up. And I think indeed that goes into what you just pointed out. So from my perspective, that really begs for revisiting why is everything time-based? Or, why is time factor into it so greatly? And that also plays into wanting to push more into value-based payments where arguably, you want to devote more time where it's appropriate, and you want to drive efficiency and reduce the time spent on certain other matters that are maybe less complex or don't require the same level of intervention. So it's if you can get into a more capitated or risk-based arrangement, then you're going to want to figure out what are the best workflows for each type of service that you're providing. So it's I think that this will end up helping to drive and promote a different perspective when it comes to thinking about, how much should time factor into what the reimbursement level is. I fully recognize that that is, a really difficult issue right now when largely, as a lawyer, I hate to say every, but it's a very large percentage of organizations are living in both a value and fee for service world. And that can create tension for use of tools like this, which I think needs to be figured out because on the fee for service side, if you drive too much efficiency and now you're cutting reimbursement from time-based codes and you're not making that up on the value side, there's going to be a pretty strong disincentive to, appropriately use the technology solution. So it is certainly something that is a policy issue that needs to, I think be discussed and figured out if we're going to really see effective utilization of these evolving technologies throughout healthcare.
Yes, I completely agree. And this is a good sweat segue into what we said we're going to talk about, which is liability. I was recently in a at a conference in the EU, and there was a question in a roundtable about a AI-assisted clinical decision that led to patient harm. And the question was, who is at fault here? Is it the doctor, the patient, the health system who vetted and using the AI software, or is it the AI vendor itself? And it was interesting to me because across the board, because most people were European, they said it was actually on the AI vendor. I do, or the health system that was supposed to vet it. It was actually not on the individual, which I think is very interesting in the way that they think about healthcare. But now bringing it over to our side, because I come from the US and I even thought about it differently. Who do you think is going to be liable or should be liable when AI-assisted clinical decisions lead to harm? Or what do we put in place to make sure that we have a great process or a safe process when those things occur, because they are inevitable.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess the glib answer is everyone's going to be liable because that is typically how the medical malpractice system works in the United States. It's if you've ever seen a complaint in a med mal case, anyone who potentially saw the patient is very often named by the plaintiff, and then it all gets sorted out through the course of the litigation where. If you're able to show that a certain party has had zero connection to the patient, their name just happened to pop up in the record, they very will likely get dismissed out of the case, and then it just filters on down. So it's I think no matter what anyone tries to do from a contractual perspective, around use of the services, you're still going to see attempts at bringing everyone into the suit. I think now bringing it kind of more granularly. If you really have an AI system that is driving a decision, my viewpoint is I don't think you can wholly disclaim the liability there. If you're promoting a product that you're saying can make clinical decisions, then you have to be able to stand behind that and bear responsibility if that leads to a problem. Then when you flip it to the hospital or the individual clinician side, to your point, Aditi, there is an obligation to have to understand the care that you're delivering. You can't just blindly rely on a tool. So you should, while you're very likely not going to be able to fully understand what the tool is specifically doing, just because, the complexity of technology might preclude that, you should at least be able to have some insight into how that decision was getting arrived at and, how you're going to act upon it. It's not a clean analogy, but it's, there is, around the ambient AI that, Charles had talked kind of briefly mentioned, where, it's recording the note and helping to generate the note. A question I see come up fairly frequently on that side from clients is, but what do I do with that? Well, the clinician can't just sign the note without reviewing it. If they do that, they're certifying that it's accurate, and any inaccuracies that might come up that could result in either harm down the road or, problematic billing, clinician's going to be responsible because they're the one who signed off on it. I can see a similar argument being raised around use of an AI tool or any other, technology-based solution in decision making, that if you just blindly rely on it, you're still going to be rely you're still going to be bear responsibility because you still have a decision to make in that process. Now, looking maybe further down the road, if the AI solution is the only thing delivering care, again, absolutely no way from my perspective that it can avoid liability, but then it starts to, bleed into a different direction of licensure. And, obviously we know that doctors and, other professionals who are providing healthcare services, a lot of them require professional licensure. Are you going to apply the same thing to the AI solution, and who's going to be responsible for administering and overseeing a licensure program like that, which will also drive liability determinations?
Yeah, that's great. And I was, it reminds me of a follow-up question, what you were just saying about is that part of the hesitation for a lot of clinicians to use a clinical decision making is this exact question, because the reality is we do not really understand how these LLMs work to that degree. Now, myself, I practiced emergency medicine for 14 years. I can look and say, okay, I can understand maybe where this is or where this came from. But it ends up being more difficult for newer doctors or students who are still learning and getting some of that experience. So how do we even, bridge that gap? And also just what you're talking about, bringing in companies into malpractice suits. When I do chart reviews, I've done some for telemedicine. The telemedicine company, of course, is not the one that's brought into the suit itself. But, if it's an AI tool, there is that possibility in the future. And is someone going to be suing Google, bringing them into a malpractice case or open evidence? I mean, that would be something. But Charles, I wanted to hear get your perspective on this as well.
Yeah, I mean, of course, examining and consulting with patients and, using technology and other clinical decision support systems is just the reality. It's going to continue to expand. Medical schools are integrating it into their course and curriculums, as you referenced, and just getting them providers and clinicians more experienced with it. This is certainly an area that there's still uncertainty of exactly what providers can do and trying to utilize this technology and what they can do to shield themselves from potential malpractice liability. Of course, we advise both practice providers or large hospitals or health systems that are adopting this type of technology to engage in, as Matt said, in due diligence, evaluate the AI systems, before implementing them in the practice setting. From just a practical standpoint, make sure that you even have professional liability insurance coverage for things like AI and ML technology, similar to, the same question marks that come up about, do you have proper coverage for cybersecurity, the delivery of telemedicine services? What are the limitations? And any affirmative obligations you have to disclose that to your insurance carrier. I mean, these are just practical advice, but certainly, things to, again, continue to highlight that should be done. But from a liability standpoint, it's an evolving landscape, as Matt, I believe, was indicating. There's going to be what I would call a sort of comparative fault, depending on the facts in the case, and where liability is going to be allocated between professional and or product liability. We've already seen some cases recent involving AI ML software. The Loew v. Cerner is a very popular one, and still yet to be fully determined, but at least the federal courts determined that in that case, the Cerner, which is an EMR company, and had some when integrated some software and clinical decision support systems into their services, that they could be held liable in the delivery setting, healthcare delivery setting, for design defects, failure to warn, all of those issues that come up with, is it complete, is it sufficiently described to the provider of what these limitations are, things that the FDA requires, but can be the construct for a product liability case. One of the ones that I found interesting that I came across was out of Alabama. It's called Sampson and Hartwise, where there was provider reliance, without an exam, or at least the exact allegation, and failure to use, those resources that were available. In this case, that it proceeded forward with the malpractice suit, but the software vendor was actually removed or dismissed from the case because the causes of action were brought under a medical liability act. And the court determined that that malpractice claim only applied to healthcare providers, not to technology companies. So again, those are examples of how ultimately these issues of liability are going to play out in civil litigation in the courts in the U.S. And without some definitive standards, national standards, or uniform standards, these issues are going to be left to local and community level courts, and appropriate standards of care, and utilizing AI and ML tools. So still to be seen, and a lot to continue to follow as this plays out.
Wow. Just thinking about that precedent it's setting that technology companies are not liable for any of it because I just think it's a very interesting precedent to set. And it also brings now to the next thing you were talking about with regulations. So this is going to be our last question. So I appreciate all of the input so far, but really let's talk about it from now the bird's eye view. There is the new Medicare physician fee services changes for 2026 that you guys brought up. And then also this new AI action plan that's been set up. And what do you see as some of the benefits from both of these changes happening? For me personally, the AI action plan has the idea of making regulatory sandboxes so people can actually experiment in a safe manner with AI rather than it being the Wild West that it tends to happen when tech companies are trying to implement and force it onto other people. So I find that will be really interesting to see, and we'll see what the FDA does or what is considered a medical device after that. So how about you? What are you guys excited to see from the government changes, the federal government, or what are you a little bit worried about either? No, both. Matt, let's start with you.
Sure. So I think anytime that you see the government trying to engage the industry in experimenting and in trying to figure it out, as you said, there can be positives there. From the fee schedule perspective, as we were talking about earlier, I think you're still going to see yearly evolution and changing understanding of what, if any, coverage should exist. So, the fact that it's starting to be incorporated is certainly a positive sign, but now we need to figure out, what actually gets implemented, because as Charles pointed out, right now we only have the proposed rule, which is typically finalized, a little bit before the end of each calendar year for the upcoming year. So still to be determined exactly what the changes will be, but it really does require tracking year over year, and then making sure you're engaging in that rulemaking process, because by submitting comments and feedback, that does help inform the policy. So looking at the federal perspective, yeah, it seems like it's moving in a positive direction. The bigger issue that I think is going to be an interplay with that is the states are moving more quickly. There's already been a couple states that have passed AI focused laws, and there are bills pending in other states around the country. So I could very easily see a patchwork approach growing, similar to what has been seen on the privacy front, where you have a whole host of varying state laws that are, different flavors around the same concept, but all have slightly different nuances. That makes it more challenging because you then have to figure out how do I fit within all these different schemes and what are the different requirements going to be. So, my personal perspective is I would, when it comes to big overarching issues like this, we're talking AI, privacy, or really any big health policy issue, my preference is I would love for one federal scheme to exist that sets standards across the country that everyone needs to follow. One, it helps development, it helps adoption and utilization, but it also helps from the compliance perspective because you're not dealing with our potentially 50 plus different things that you need to pay attention to from a company perspective or a user perspective. So it's, there are signs of hope, but there is obviously going to be a lot of work to be done. And, hopefully we can move in a direction where we set a level playing field that where everyone's playing by the same rules.
I would love to see that standardization of regulation as well. Clinicians are really afraid of some of this because we're afraid that all the liability is going to go on us, but we do want our jobs to become easier. So I completely agree. How about yourself, Charles?
I think Matt touches on many really important topics, especially the fragmented regulatory environment that providers operate in is very challenging. And I think what we can reflect on is that's probably going to continue as more and more power is otherwise being deferred to and directed back to the states. So it'd be great to have those national standards, especially on, privacy, licensure, all of those issues that are important to expanding digital health broadly. But aside from that, and not to go through the things that Matt had already identified, I think it's very clear from a policy trend. And when we released our firm release, sort of, what is it? What does a change in administration mean? And from a healthcare standpoint, we were pretty confident that it meant expansion of, digital health and digital therapeutics, wearables, biosensors, all of the things that we are seeing playing out, that we are seeing being promoted, especially the adoption and how to adopt and utilize AI and ML to provide, hopefully better patient care, but also reduce costs in healthcare. I think that's going to continue to move forward. And of course, the proposed rules are a reflection of that, as well as all of the, underlying waiver programs and demonstration programs that you indicated are out there and they're being promoted. So, I think this is a great, time for our clients, whether they are hospitals, health systems, and providers, or software and technology companies out there operating in the healthcare industry, to, as Matt said, be involved, have that voice in how these things are being implemented going forward. I would say an example of that is the communications that we've even had with the FDA and the reviewers and wanting feedback and wanting all of those programs that the FDA has adopted to wanting guidance on AI and ML to learn more, ARC can be involved either directly or through trade associations in assisting the government to better understand that and assisting the government to adopt and promote these technologies the way that the market needs them to be adopted.
I completely want to second that. CMS is always actively soliciting comments. I work on the AMA Digital Medicine Committee, and we are always looking for comments. We are working on AI currently. So I wanted to thank you for this conversation. We could talk about this probably for hours. This is a huge space. There's a lot of things that we can talk about how it's going to be different. How do we implement it in healthcare? What is relevant to the market, to health systems, to patients, to clinician, and really about the liability and regulations. It's a huge topic. And so I'm going to second that, please, if you have input, do share it, whether through your association or to any of the organizations listed, to be able to do that. And so just a quick wrap up, I want to thank Matt and Charles. And Charles, really quickly, I know you're going to be speaking. Please tell us what are you going to be speaking about in October at the ConvU2X Smart Tech Transformation event?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to get into depth on some of these issues. Panel discussion that we have planned is going to talk about these, how legislatures and agencies at the federal and state levels are evaluating, changes to expand and regulate access to telehealth services and digital health technologies. We're going to, talk about policy making and AI governance issues. I think we'll focus in on, like I alluded to, some of the FDA oversight and enhancements and calls for RFIs and the like from CMS. And then I think we'll get into a little bit more of the data privacy and security measures because that's really critical, obviously, for AI and ML. It's all based upon big data. So those issues and some things that are being implemented or expanded or pending, just to give our attendees a real in-depth look at those issues.
Sounds great. So for our listeners, what we were talking about, if you're passionate about what we shared today for digital transformation, don't miss the ConvU2X Smart Tech Transformation event this October, 30th to 31st in New York City. Charles Firm is a sponsor. You heard what a very interesting talk is going to be given. And you can register at telehealth.conv2xsymposium.com. Thank you both. Thank you all for listening. And let us know if you have any comments or questions on this very important topic as we build the future of healthcare.
We appreciate your tuning in to the Telehealth and Medicine Today podcast series. Do you want to learn more or have a comment? Do you have a novel topic or solution to share with our audience? If so, send an email to info@partnersindigitalhealth.com or visit the open access peer-reviewed journal Telehealth and Medicine Today and stay up to date with exciting articles that bridge research with real-world frontline impact. Thanks for listening.